Chapter 22. The Willpower Method of Stopping. It's an accepted fact in our society that it's very difficult to stop smoking. Even books advising you how to do so usually start off by telling you how difficult it is. The truth is that it's ridiculously easy. Yes, I can understand you're questioning that statement, but just consider it. If your aim is to run a mile in under 4 minutes, that's difficult. You may have to undergo years of hard training, and even then you may be physically incapable of doing it. Much of our achievement lies in the mind. Isn't it strange how difficult a 4 minute mile was until Roger Bannister actually did it? But nowadays, it's commonplace. However, in order to stop smoking, all you have to do is not smoke anymore. No one forces you to smoke, apart from yourself. And unlike food or drink, you don't need it to survive. So if you want to stop doing it, why should it be difficult? In fact, it isn't. It is smokers who make it difficult by using the willpower method. I define the willpower method as any method that forces the smoker to feel he's making some sort of sacrifice. Let's just consider the willpower method. We don't decide to become smokers. We merely experiment with the first few cigarettes, and because they taste awful, we're convinced that we can stop whenever we want to. In the beginning, we smoke those first few cigarettes only when we want to, and that's usually in the company of other smokers on social occasions. Before we realize it, we're not only buying cigarettes regularly and smoking when we want to, we're smoking every day. Smoking has become a part of our lives. We ensure that we always have a cigarette on our person. We believe that social occasions and meals are improved by them and that they relieve stress. It doesn't seem to occur to us that the same cigarette out of the same pack will taste exactly the same after a meal as it does first thing in the morning. In fact, smoking neither improves meals and social occasions, nor does it relieve stress. It's just that smokers believe they can't enjoy a meal or handle stress without a cigarette. It usually takes us a long time to realize that we're hooked, because we suffer from the illusion that we smoke because we enjoy a cigarette, not because we have to have a cigarette. While we're not enjoying cigarettes, which we never do, we suffer from the illusion that we can stop whenever we want to. Usually it's not until we actually try to stop that we realize a problem exists. The first attempts to stop are more often than not in the early days, and are usually triggered by shortage of money, boy meets girl and they're saving to set up home and don't want to waste money on cigarettes, or health concerns. The teenager is still active in sports and finds he's short of breath. Whatever the reason, the smoker always waits for a stressful situation. As soon as he stops, the little monster needs feeding. The smoker then wants a cigarette, and because he can't have one, he feels more distressed. The thing he usually takes to relieve stress is now not available, so he suffers a triple blow. The probable result after a period of torture is the compromise, "I'll cut down," or "I've picked the wrong time," or "I'll wait until the stress is gone from my life." However, once the stress has gone, he has no need to stop and doesn't decide to do so again until the next stressful time. Of course, the time is never right, because life for most people doesn't become less stressful. It becomes more so. We leave the protection of our parents and enter the world of setting up home, taking on mortgages, having children, working responsible jobs, and so forth. Of course, the smoker's life can never become less stressful because it's a cigarette that actually causes stress. As the smoker's rate of nicotine intake rises, the more distressed he becomes, and the greater the illusion of his dependency becomes. In fact, it is an illusion that life becomes more stressful, and it's the smoking itself or a similar crutch that creates the illusion. This will be discussed in greater detail in Chapter 28. After the initial failures, the smoker usually relies on the possibility that one day he'll wake up and just not want to smoke anymore. This hope is usually kindled by the stories that he's heard about ex-smokers, such as, "I had a bout of flu, and afterwards I didn't want to smoke anymore." Don't kid yourself. I've probed all these rumours, and they're never quite as simple as they appear. Usually, the smoker has already been preparing himself to stop, and merely used the flu as a springboard. I spent 30-odd years waiting to wake up one morning wanting never to smoke again. But whenever I had a bad cold, I would look forward to its ending, because it was interfering with my smoking. More often in the case of people who stop just like that, they've suffered a shock. Perhaps a close relative has died from a cigarette-related disease, or they've had a scare themselves. It's so much easier to say, "I just decided to stop one day. That's the sort of guy I am." Stop kidding yourself. It won't happen unless you make it happen. Let's consider in greater detail why the willpower method is so difficult. For most of our lives, we adopt the head-in-the-sand, I'll-stop-tomorrow approach. At odd times, something will trigger an attempt to stop. It may be concern about health, money, or social stigma. Or we may have been going through a particularly heavy bout of choking and realize that we don't actually enjoy it. Whatever the reason, we take our head out of the sand and start weighing the pros and cons of smoking. We then find out what we've known all our lives. On a rational assessment, the conclusion is, a dozen times over, stop smoking. If you were to sit down and give points for all the advantages of stopping, and do a similar exercise with the advantages of smoking, the total point count for stopping would far outweigh that for continuing. However, although the smoker knows he'll be better off as a non-smoker, he believes that by quitting, he's making a sacrifice. Although it's an illusion, it is a powerful illusion. The smoker doesn't know why, but he believes that during the good times and bad times of life, the cigarette does appear to help. Before he starts the attempts to quit, he's affected by the brainwashing of our society, reinforced by the brainwashing of his own addiction. To these must be added the even more powerful brainwashing of how difficult it is to give up. He's heard stories of smokers who have stopped for many months and are still desperately craving a cigarette. He's heard of the disgruntled stoppers, those who stop and then spend the rest of their lives bemoaning the fact that they'd love a cigarette. He's heard of smokers who have stopped for many years, apparently leading happy lives, but have one cigarette and are suddenly hooked again. Probably he also knows several smokers in the advanced stages of the disease who are visibly destroying themselves and are clearly not enjoying cigarettes, yet they continue to smoke. Added to all this, he has probably already suffered one or more of these experiences himself. So, instead of starting with the feeling, "Great, have you heard the news? I don't have to smoke anymore," he starts with a feeling of doom and gloom, as if he were trying to climb Mount Everest. He firmly believes that once the little monster has got his hooks into you, you are hooked for life. Many smokers even start the attempt by apologizing to their friends and relatives. "Look, I'm trying to give up smoking. I'll probably be irritable during the next few weeks. Try to bear with me." Most attempts are doomed before they start. Let's assume that the smoker survives a few days without a cigarette. The congestion is rapidly disappearing from his lungs. He hasn't bought cigarettes and consequently has more money in his pocket. So the reasons why he decided to stop in the first place are rapidly disappearing from his thoughts. It's like seeing a bad road accident when you're driving. It slows you down for a while, but the next time you're late for an appointment, you've forgotten all about it and your foot stamps on the throttle. On the other side of the tug of war, that little monster inside your stomach hasn't had his fix. There's no physical pain. If you had the same feeling because of a cold, you wouldn't stop working or get depressed. You would laugh it off. All the smoker knows is that he wants a cigarette. Why is it so important to him? He doesn't know. The little monster in the stomach then triggers the big monster in the mind. And soon the person who a few hours or days earlier was listing all the reasons to stop smoking is desperately searching for any excuse to start again. Now he's saying things like, 1. Life is too short. The bomb could go off. I could get hit by a bus tomorrow. I've left it too late. Everything gives you cancer these days. 2. I've picked the wrong time. I should have waited until after the holidays, after my vacation, after this stressful event in my life. And 3, I can't concentrate. I'm getting irritable and bad-tempered. I can't do my job properly. My family and friends won't love me. Let's face it, for everybody's sake, I need to start smoking again. I'm a confirmed smoker, and there's no way I will ever be happy again without a cigarette. This one kept me smoking for 33 years. At this stage, the smoker usually gives in. He lights a cigarette, and the schizophrenia increases. On the one hand, there is the tremendous relief of ending the craving, when the little monster finally gets his fix. On the other hand, If the smoker has survived a long time without a cigarette, it tastes awful, and the smoker can't understand why he's smoking it. This is why the smoker thinks he lacks willpower. In fact, it's not lack of willpower. He has simply changed his mind and made a perfectly rational decision in the light of the latest information. What's the point of being healthy if you're miserable? What's the point of being rich if you're miserable? There is none. It is far better to have a shorter, enjoyable life than a lengthy, miserable life. Fortunately, the smoker's rationale does not reflect the truth. Life as a non-smoker is infinitely more enjoyable. Yet it was the delusion that it is less enjoyable that kept me smoking for 33 years. And I must confess, if that were the true situation, I would still be smoking. Correction, I wouldn't be here. The misery that the smoker is suffering has nothing to do with withdrawal pangs. True, pangs trigger the misery, but the actual agony is in the mind, caused by doubt and uncertainty. Because the smoker starts by feeling he's making a sacrifice, he begins to feel deprived. This is a form of stress. One of the times when his brain tells him, have a cigarette, is a time of stress. Therefore, as soon as he stops smoking, he wants a cigarette. But now he can't have one because he has stopped smoking. This makes him more depressed, which sets the trigger off again. Another thing that makes it so difficult is that you're waiting for something to happen. If your object is to pass a driving test, as soon as you've passed the test, it is certain you've achieved your object. Under the willpower method, you say, if I can go long enough without a cigarette, the urge to smoke will eventually go. How do you know when you've achieved it? The answer is that you never do, because you're waiting for something to happen, and nothing else is going to happen. You stopped when you smoked that last cigarette, and what you're really doing now is waiting to see how long it will be before you give in. As I said before, the agony that the smoker undergoes is mental, caused by the uncertainty. Although there's no physical pain, the mental agony still has a powerful effect. The smoker is miserable and insecure. Far from forgetting about smoking, his mind becomes obsessed with it. There can be days or even weeks of black depression. His mind is obsessed with doubts and fears. How long will the craving last? Will I ever be happy again? Will I ever want to get up in the morning? Will I ever enjoy a meal again? How will I ever cope with stress in the future? Will I ever enjoy a social function again? The smoker is waiting for things to improve. But of course, while he's still moping, the cigarette is becoming more precious. In fact, something does happen, but the smoker isn't conscious of it. If he can survive 3 weeks without inhaling any nicotine at all, the physical cravings for nicotine disappears. However, as stated before, the pangs of withdrawal from nicotine are so mild that the smoker isn't aware of them. But after about 3 weeks, many smokers sense that they've kicked it. They then light a cigarette to prove it, and it does just that. It tastes awful. But the ex-smoker has now supplied nicotine to the body, and as soon as he extinguishes that cigarette, the nicotine starts to leave the body. There is now a little voice at the back of his mind saying, "You want another one." In fact, he had kicked it, but now he has hooked himself again. The smoker will not usually light another cigarette immediately. He thinks, I don't want to get hooked again. So he allows a safe period to pass. It might be hours, days, even weeks. The ex-smoker can now say, well, I didn't get hooked, so I can safely have another. He has fallen into the same trap as he did in the first place, and is already on the slippery slope. Smokers who succeed under the willpower method tend to find it long and difficult, because the main problem is the brainwashing, and long after the physical addiction has died, the smoker is still moping about cigarettes. Eventually, if he can survive long enough, it begins to dawn on him that he's not going to give in. He stops moping and accepts that life goes on and is enjoyable without the cigarette. Many smokers are succeeding with this method, but it's difficult and arduous, and there are many more failures than successes. Even those who do succeed go through the rest of their lives in a vulnerable state. They're left with a certain amount of brainwashing and still believe that the cigarette can give you a boost. Most non-smokers also suffer from that illusion, They're subjected to brainwashing also, but either find they can't learn to enjoy smoking or don't want the bad side, thank you very much. This explains why many smokers who have stopped for long periods start smoking again. Many ex-smokers will have the occasional cigar or cigarette either as a special treat or to convince themselves how awful it is. It does exactly that. But as soon as they put it out, the nicotine starts to leave and a little voice at the back of their mind is saying, "You want another one." If they light another one, it still tastes awful and they say, "Marvellous. While I'm not enjoying it, I won't get hooked. After the holidays, vacation, this trauma, I will stop." Too late. They're already hooked. The trap that they fell into in the first place has claimed its victim again. As I keep saying, enjoyment doesn't come into it. It never did. If we smoked because we enjoyed it, nobody would ever smoke more than one cigarette. We assume we enjoy cigarettes only because we can't believe we would be stupid enough to smoke if we didn't enjoy them. This is why so much of our smoking is subconscious. If while smoking every cigarette, you were aware of the foul fumes going into your lungs, and you had to say to yourself, "This is going to cost $100,000 in my lifetime, and this cigarette might be just the one to trigger cancer in my lungs," even the illusion of enjoyment would go. When we try to block our minds to the bad side, we feel stupid. If we had to face up to it, that would be intolerable. If you watch smokers, particularly at social functions, you'll see that they're happy only when they're not aware that they're smoking. Once they become aware of it, they tend to be uncomfortable and apologetic. You smoke to feed that little monster. And once you've purged the little monster from your body and the big monster from your brain, you will have neither need nor desire to smoke.